I don't know why it was my favorite. Maybe because it's just like the fireworks of it all. But I felt like if humanity was going to meet our end, I'd rather be through something outside of our planet and than feeling like we just screwed it up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's
you know,
great.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't want us to have it's to like, take accountability, yeah. Put it that way.
Yeah. That's a refreshing way to think of it, right? It's like, oh,
it wasn't our fault.
I'm Gabe.
And I'm Kat.
And we're the Ghouls Next Door. Talking about spooky stuff.
As we do every week.
Like space. Yeah. And the future. And colonization.
Yeah, and a parallel of reality, but just like where we're in space now.
Yeah.
Instead of just on the planet.
Yeah, dwindling resources, but also on other planets.
Yeah.
Abusing workers on other planets
everywhere,
now.
But other planets, yeah, exactly.
exactly. We are the media literacy show from a horror lens where we explore the real life, psychological, and science fiction reasonings behind our cinematic fears. And we are in a new series about science fiction specifically and the ways that it could tell us the truth about us, the truth of our future if we do not heed the warnings. But also, there are some uplifting stories that we can find in certain areas too. Just even in seeing ourselves represented in the future is a big step. So we're today going to be talking about The Expanse, which is one of my favorite shows. If you're watching, I am in full cosplay Naomi, and was one of my favorite cosplays to do. It's like the first one I did that was very intentional.
Yeah.
Not just kind of like thrown together with other pieces that I found.
Yeah, I believe you wore it to the Fan Expo Philly last year.
I did, because we were going to do this last year. Mm-hmm. But it's all good. And, you know, we've been wanting to do like a space or sci-fi series just because, one, it's fun, but because there's so much to be said about like how we envision ourselves in the future. Mm-hmm. And just the creativity that comes with that like the stories of like people are all the same, but then it's like there's cool technology now or scary technology now. Mm-hmm. That adds to the experience and allows you to look at it in a different lens. And maybe be even more critical or understanding of it.
Yeah, human nature, but also like deciding what that is under slightly different circumstances that all kind of mimic our current circumstances is like a warning of space.
Yes. Exactly. And for this series, we are going to have guests. It's been a minute since we've invited other folks on. We've been covering all kinds of things or just like running. But this one, we really wanted to feature some other voices and talk to big fans of the work, but people who like get it in the same way that we get it, like and appreciate this media in the way that we appreciate media. And today we're going to be inviting Lee Sumpter, who I am a very big fan of. And so I'm very excited to hear her thoughts and to learn a bit more about her. So let's bring in Lee. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here with you all. This is going to be fun.
Yes. For folks listening, joining us, I'll tell you a little bit about our guests so that you know why we invited them specifically on for this episode. One, because they're a big fan of The Expanse, just like us. But they're an expert in these very ideas. So Lee Sumpter is a mythologist, a multidisciplinary artist, and an independent scholar who applies strategies of world building and mythic design towards creating better, more resilient communities of the future. And the ways that you do that is so phenomenal. Right. It's like, I didn't even know we could do that. Like, I didn't know we could think outside of the box in this way that you do, in the ways of like, you know, supporting your community and envisioning your communities in the way that we have existed and the way that we will exist. Mm-hmm. And that's really powerful. And so for our listeners, could you tell us a bit about the work that you do and what you're working on these days?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that intro, Gabe. I am a mythologist, and a lot of people are like, okay, well, what is that? But I actually went to school. I went to Pacifica Graduate Institute and completed my PhD in mythological studies and depth psychology. And I wrote my dissertation on apocalyptic film and media, and really looked at the patterns that, the visual patterns and the narrative patterns that we see in everything from, like, you know, sci-fi to some aspects of horror, even though horror is a genre I don't have the courage for at all times, but little by little, I find myself really being intrigued with the way that the horror genre is going right now. You know, there's a lot of real drama and exciting storylines that you can see in the horror genre now that also kind of outweigh the scary parts for me, or at least when yes. I'm in good company. But so what I learned when I was writing my dissertation on apocalyptic film was that there's so much that films can teach us, you know, about the future, about how humans will fare in the future, you know, for better or for worse, you know. And unfortunately, a lot of times mm-hmm. the films that we see, it's often for worse, you know, the mm-hmm. catastrophic worse, you know. And so I really wanted to think about how, you know, we can look at the ways these stories are told to kind of glean and pull from those things ideas and strategies to support us in real life, you know. But then also mm-hmm. thinking of ways that how these stories are constructed and how, because I love how you talk about mythic literacy, because that was really my background as an educator in art and media literacy. And so I approached my study of film in that way, really from that educator's point of view, in thinking about mythology as a literacy, you know, as thinking about mythic mm-hmm. literacy as the study and of the patterns of myth in terms of archetype and symbol, and how they really kind of formulate this language that we can deconstruct as well as create on our own to make new stories. And so, you know, what I'm doing now is trying to use my knowledge of mythology that I learned to create my own stories about where I live, you know, because I think some of the best science fiction is, you know, really built on the here and now and that speculative what if, like, you know, a la Octavia Butler and so many of the sci-fi and speculative writers that we're looking to now in this age of, you know, a pandemic and so many other things that are going wrong with mm-hmm. the planet and our society, to where we can think about, well, what would we do in the near future? You know, not necessarily like millennia from now, but the very near future. We're talking like in the next 20 years, like what would life be like? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of stories that we like Blade Runner, and even, like I said, Octavia Butler's story, like a lot of these are happening in a time very much like our own. So I'm really trying to find strategies using these stories to get people motivated and raising awareness about how we can prepare for that future. And not just the scary stuff, but the things that actually we have to look forward to, because we got to believe there's something to look forward to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a big part of our program is thinking about how these stories impact us, right? It impacts the way that we understand the world around us and how we understand ourselves, and then how we can envision a future. And, you know, media has power in that way, right? It could convince us that, you know, if things are going to go bad, then we're reacting like things are going to go bad, or it can convince us that we're going to be okay. And then we can approach that in that same way, in that same mentality. And when we, you know, recently we covered Octavia Butler. So some of our listeners might have a good idea of what Afrofuturism is, and speculative fiction in that way, and how it was a combination of horror in that it was very horrific, yeah. right? The circumstances yeah. of the Parable of Sower and Talents. But then there was this really beautiful thread of hope and resilience mm-hmm. that Octavia brings into her work that is really inspiring. And it was like, it definitely moved us, like something where we were like, that's the future that we got to see. Like, we have to acknowledge that, there's going to be damage to our planet, that there are always going to be, you know, systems in power that are oppressive and trying to harm folks. And so it's just a matter of how do we live in that same world? How do we try to dismantle those things and move forward and reshape our future in that way? Yeah. So all the things you said, it's something that really resonates with us and what we look for when we're trying to find media that matters to us and is worth unpacking or discussing. Yeah. And oftentimes even combating media that's not doing it or is not doing it in the right way. And it's like, why? Like, who was in this writer's room, right? Who's behind this?
Or even pushing us closer towards the end, to tell? Right? In a bad way. Some of these stories are not helping at all.
Yeah. Well, because it's all like, is it inspiring hope or is it just like perpetuating the idea that all of this is inevitable, so there's nothing we can do? Like when we talked about Don't Look Up, that was like very much the vibe you left with, which is not like a productive vibe. You know, you're like, oh, there's nothing we can do. The world is ending. We might as well just sit here and wait. Don't look up at it. Just let it happen. Where like the reality is that, no, you have to look at it so that you can fix it.
No,
that was a way more hopeful perspective.
That was a crazy ride. Didn't that come out like around the holiday time, like the Christmas, New Year's holiday?
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, you know, it was funny, but I mean, but not funny, right? You know? No, it's crazy because we are definitely living in a time where, you know, hope is really essential. Like we really do have to have something to aspire to live for. And the stories that we consume, because we're constantly consuming narratives, whether it's on the big screen, small screen, or all the screens in between. And, you know, those things do have an impact on us and ultimately shape, you know, our view on reality and where we're headed. And the idea of fear mongering, Kat, as you brought up too, it's like, I, you know, when I would apply for grants and things like that for my project, the Escape Artist Initiative, I was promoting this idea of the art of survival. And a lot of the times it was these apocalyptic narratives that were the backdrop for my projects. And a lot of people were thinking like, and I was making these submissions for things long before the pandemic. You know, it really wasn't until 2020 that people started saying, oh, you know, we can see the value in trying to prepare for such things, you know, and using the arts as a tool for social change or to raise awareness about these things. But believe me, I definitely got the thing of like, you know, why are you being so nihilist or why are you being so gloom and doom? You know, we don't really have room for that. We're looking for hopeful projects. But no one can say that Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, with the, you know, introduction of Earthseed and this idea of this new religion that, you know, explores ideas of taking root among the stars, is not hopeful and aspirational. So we have to kind of like see the forest through the trees with some of these stories.
Yeah, that's, you know, and that's something that we are often kind of combating as well, like that idea of like covering horror, right? There's this idea of us that we're just always talking about these dark, horrible, like tragic things, that we must just always be miserable. And sometimes things do really get heavy and we need, you know, to take breaks and do something more fun. But what we try to do is always bring in, you know, ways to help and kind of we unpack the horrors that are happening, but then we take a look and say, how can we fix this, right? How can we change this? And it's so funny that like you were working on like apocalyptic things in preparation before the pandemic, because our apocalypse series was in 2019. And I remember us covering like a viral apocalypse and talking about like pandemics and like, you know, wash your hands and do all this stuff. And so it was part of like, here's how, what it would actually look like, and here's how you prepare. And that was that whole series. And then like a year later, everyone was like, wow, how did you know?
I know. it's a strange feeling. It was like that hyper real of that experience. I experienced that as well in my classroom. I was teaching Parable of the Sower. I was teaching an Afrofuturism class at Moore College of Art and Design. And we we're doing journal entries around Parable of the Sower, because as you know, Lauren Olamina, the lead protagonist, often writes in her journal, and that's one of the narrative threads of the book. And so we were doing that in the classroom, and we were kind of speculating, well, what if, because at the time, the coronavirus was only in China, and it hadn't gotten to the U.S. yet, and nobody really thought it would get here, that it would be kind of stopped in its tracks, and, the rest of the world wouldn't have to worry about it. But then next thing you know, we are switching to virtual learning, and we're continuing our lessons, from these screens and from Zoom. And it was just like, it was hard to handle, because the book is scary for a lot of students, for anybody who's reading it for the first time, and is not already like familiar with, where Octavia Butler can go with her imagination. But the thing is that, her imagination was really nailing so close to home with that particular story. And so, the hyper real, like when art imitates life and vice versa, it can be transformative, but it can also scare the stuff out of you,
Yeah, I think, and then that's important, right? Is like a fear can be used as a good tool, right? It could be, a negative tool when it's fear mongering, but it could also be motivational in that way of like, I need to not allow this to happen, or like to really see what's going on. I've seen some of your work in having discussions about things like Attack the Block, or as you were saying, like Octavia Butler. And so for our listeners, what are some, works that you've explored that you feel are really pivotal with these messages that would be really great to just have in your like study guide to the future, or just to like speculative fiction and Afrofuturism?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Well, I will say that some of the ones that are just coming off the top of my head, because I recently did a course on Afrofuturism in the heroine's journey, but looking at it through the eyes of like a female or a femme protagonist. And so I thought of The Girl with All the Gifts. Have you seen that film? Right? With the young girl and like, and again, we're dealing with the virus, right? Like, viruses are, they never get old in the future, boy. Like, we love that. And as we talk about The Expanse, we know that that's what the proto-molecule is too, And then also to Fast Color. I really like that one. It was like a different approach to the apocalypse. And again, it's like apocalypse isn't always like the driving plot force, all the time. Sometimes it's just the backdrop, because if you remember, if you saw Fast Color, right? Fast Color was speaking to this intergenerational power and gifts that these family of women had. And, you saw like the mother, daughter, and grandmother dealing with like these special powers in a world where, climate change had taken over and like the world was dying, but that wasn't really the focus. It was really about the relationship of these families and the powers that they had come to harness, and what that meant for the future of humanity and just like our possibilities, as we kind of evolve and adapt to the changing world, so that one is someone who's really interested in apocalypse and like the stories that affect the planet, like our global destiny. I really like Fast Color for that reason. And again, The Expanse, like for me, even though like for me, like the stories that deal with like the distant future, because this one really is out in the future, there was so much about the world building. Like I love stories that really tap into the world building of this epic nature. I mean, it doesn't get much more epic than The Expanse. I mean, because of the way that world was constructed. But I did really enjoy also like to get into the zombie thing again. 28 Days Later is one of my favorites, even though it's that was challenging. But that protagonist, like I feel like she Selena, right, was her name, I believe. She really, I remember seeing that film before The Walking Dead came out and before it became like the series on HBO. Yeah. And so when we saw Michonne from The Walking Dead, it was just like, wow, like Selena immediately came to mind. And, you know, there's so many of these recurring characters that are really just so strong and can carry so much on their shoulders in terms of survival of their community and the fate of the world. So I love stories for that reason. And, you know, I am also a fan of stories that take place in Philly. And it was, what is it called? Not Beyond the Shadow of the Moon, but what was it called? You know, the one about the shadow of the moon and she's time traveling. You didn't see, haven't seen that?
No.
I'm getting the title wrong, but it's something about In the Shadow of the Moon or something about the shadow of the moon, but it takes place in Philly and it deals with like time travel and stuff. And she's trying to save humans.
That's so cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That one's a good one. That one's a good one.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would throw in N.K. Jemisin, just a lot of her work, even just like the Broken Earth trilogy that we covered, but also City Born Great. And just like, you know, we're stronger as like a community than these like otherworldly elder beasts, right? That horror has so often like put on this pedestal of like the epitome of evil. And it's like, oh, it's nothing to couple folks in Bronx, you know, like it's you know, it's nothing, right. Which I think is just like exciting and refreshing, because again, we don't often get those stories of the communities winning, like people winning in the future too.
So thinking of like, so you were saying like right before the pandemic that you were pitching apocalyptic stories and how like people are like, oh, we just don't have the energy for that. Which is like really ironic considering like how life went. So it makes me think of the Inaros quote where he's like, just because you didn't see it didn't mean like they weren't doing it. He does it like way better than that, but like he was just just because you're not looking, like they were doing it slowly, so you didn't want to look at it, but now like you can't ignore it. I've made it so you can't ignore like what's happening.
Yeah.
Do you think that the pandemic itself, or even like beforehand, did you have a vision of the future that kind of aligned with where we are now, or has it transformed since the influence of the pandemic?
Wow. Yeah, that's a tough one, because I think I went through a particular thing that was pretty personal to my experience, because after writing so much and researching about apocalyptic scenarios, when the pandemic hit, you know, it was my worst case scenario, you know, of all the things, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, aside from nuclear war, right? I mean, nobody wants that either. But I would say that the viral thing was at the top of my list of the one thing I like, the way I didn't want us to go out, you know? And I think because of the way it's just, it felt like it was so hard to see it, to defend against it. You don't understand it. You know what I mean? It's so mysterious. The microscopic nature of the enemy, you know, for me, that was hard to wrap my brain around. And so when the pandemic hit, you know, I was living alone. And I really curled up in fetal position. I gotta be honest, you know, I wasn't like, oh yeah, my moment's finally come to like share my art of survival and like get my little go bags ready for everybody and, you know, post up in the neighborhood and, you know, wave my flag or something. But no, I was just like, I wanted to be with my mom, you know, but my mom's an elder. And I thought about how my daily movements would put her in danger, you know, like I wasn't really in anybody's pod. Mm-hmm. Like it was scary, but it really made me think about all the things I had already been thinking about, but really taking it that much more seriously. Like, you know, the idea that, you know, you're really only as strong as your weakest link when it comes to your community. Like you really have to know your neighbors. You really got to rely on the folks that are geographically close to you. Like you don't realize that, you know, because our worlds really did shrink, you know, when it came to the pandemic. And, you know, even thinking about living in an apartment building, like, you know, using the elevators mm-hmm. and stuff and all the ways you could just like, because, you know, and that's the thing about living in a city. Everybody knows when it comes to a pandemic, you got to get out of the city, boy, you know. And I think about, you know, a near-death experience. I kind of remember writing this essay It was around nature. It was for the Schuylkill Center. They did a project around the pandemic and photography that was inspired by the pandemic. Because, you know, everyone was trying to get out in nature and stuff, you know, because they had to get out of the house. They wanted to take walks and be in the fresh air because it was dangerous to be in closed doors, you know. And, you know, I think people started to appreciate nature more and the indifference of it, because the trees and the birds didn't know anything about the pandemic going on that we were dealing with, you know. And I think for me, you know, everyone, especially those who actually did lose some folks, you know, I have friends that really experienced really deep, tragic loss, you know, family members, you know, multiple family members lost. And I think that, you know, it really makes us think about how lucky we are. And then I myself went through a tragic situation with a carjacking here in Philadelphia. And so for me, you know, that whole pandemic year, 2020-21, I really felt like, well, what else is next? You know what I mean? And it makes you feel like, you know what? I got to live like today could be my last day. Like, I got to live like, you know, tomorrow isn't promised. And that actually got me motivated. That's how I kind of got up off my booty and was like, okay, I'm going to get it together and try to think about what there is to live for, you know? So I will say it was definitely a process. I did not jump off the bench straight away. Like, it took me a long time to kind of grapple with my own fears and frustrations and really regrets. I regretted I didn't make that bunker. And like, you know, I regretted that I didn't, you know, get that plot of land, like, you know, with my friends that had that farm out, you know, upstate New York or something. You know, it was just all these things that I, you know, and, but it's true. It's just like, that's the fine line we walk, is like, how do we just go about our daily lives knowing that at any moment something could happen? You know what I mean? There could be another pandemic. Mm-hmm. There could be a nuclear war. There could be, you know, some kind of interstellar catastrophe. Like, anything could happen, you know? Because again, like, don't look up. That was one of my, actually, I don't know why it was my favorite, maybe because it just like the fireworks of it all. But I felt like if humanity was gonna meet our end, I'd rather be through something outside of our planet and than feeling like we just screwed it up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's super fair. Yeah.
That's super, you know, right. Yeah. I don't want us to have to take accountability, put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it is a mix. That's such a refreshing way to think of it, right? It's like, oh, it wasn't our fault.
You know.
Yeah. Cause I often find, like, when it comes to like cosmic apocalypse, that there's this reckoning we have where it's like how insignificant we are in the world. Right. It's like, we mean so little that it's just like,
Melancholia was crazy.
Asher comes and now ruins our life. Yeah. 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 That's like a horror movie. That is so terrifying.
A horror movie, like, but it was
more
like,
than I would say like Evil Dead.
Right. It was very much like that Midsommar. You know, where it was like, it was bright and sunny, but it was like, it was very scary.
Terrifying.
Very terrifying. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I like this idea of like, it's kind of a little like, you know what? It's not our fault. Like, because we don't mean anything. It's not our fault. It's fine. We just got to make the most of what we got now because it's not promised. So let's just work together, get to know each other, support each other when we can. And the end's going to be what the end's going to be, right?
And then you don't feel bad about not having a bunker because it's not going to help anyway. You don't feel bad that you didn't make the stores of canned goods and things. And because, you know, you didn't have stockpile your savings. Doesn't matter. It's all a moot point.
Yeah,
when the comet is coming for us, you know.
We're all equal. Yeah. Reduces us all to the same playing field.
Just
at
reduces
that point,
us all.
Right? It doesn't matter. Yeah. Which brings me to what we're here to talk about, which is a show that immediately, like, I haven't, like, I grew up not a super big like sci-fi fan. There just wasn't a lot of sci-fi where I saw myself.
Right.
And, like, I just didn't care about a bunch of old white men in space. Like, I just didn't do anything for me. And it wasn't until I read like Octavia Butler and was like, oh, okay, like this is interesting now. Like, now I care. Right. So I really took a chance on The Expanse watching it, and then I was immediately hooked because I was like, I like, this is so thrilling. It felt so real. I love the characters. They're so honest. And then there's just, and everyone, like, I've never seen so many like powerful women, right, in these like positions where they are controlling what's going on, or they're having more to say. And you know, propelling our ideas forward and trying to support each other and just having so much more to contribute. So let me tell folks what The Expanse is about, and then we'll hop in and talk about it. So The Expanse ran from 2015 to 2022, and it's about the first season anyway. The disappearance of rich girl turned political activist links the lives of series detective, accidental ship captain, and UN politician. Amidst political tension between Earth, Mars, and the belts, they unravel the greatest conspiracy. It's created by Daniel Abraham, Mark Fergus, and Ty Frank, and, you know, directed by all sorts of folks. It is a series, and, you know, changes like throughout the seasons. There's certain threads that we find. So we're in this future where we're trying to, we've been working to colonize Mars and have acknowledged that it will take a long time, that we will not, like, the people who started the colonization will not see the fruit of their labor, which is a really big deal for humans to do. It's to plant a tree we know we won't get to see grow.
That's big, yeah.
To its fullest extent, right? There's the fact that we've been mining for resources in the asteroid belt. So we have people called belters whose bodies have been transformed because they've existed in space for forever. And anyone who listens to The Ghouls knows I'm terrified of space. So that added to it is just like, oh my God, look at what it does to your body, because we're not supposed to be up there. But there's also Earth is still there, you know,
struggling,
trying to get in there, but still controlling like these belters who are now like the working class folks, and they're fighting for their rights. And then there's also there's the protomolecule, which is terrifying. It's like, oh, like, you talk about pandemics. So there's all that to say, there's a lot to unpack with The Expanse, which is why it immediately became a part of my whole personality. I have a Boss Ming mug. Like, I got my patches.
Your outfit is amazing, by the way. Oh my God, Gabe. You slayed it with your whole thing. Is really, I love it. And the tattoo is perfect. I mean, yes. Oh my gosh.
Right?
Perfect.
I'm like, which is also, the tattoo to me was really exciting because of what it represented, right? So it was like, for the belters, they had the specific things on their necks so that they could exist out there in space, and they would often like explode. And so it would burn them. What? So it would cause these scars. Yeah. That was like the history of like the early belters,
right.
Was it caused the scars on their neck. So they recreated them as a way of like, this is my culture.
I forgot about that. Because I saw, because you know who's got it around his neck was Miller. Didn't he have it?
Yeah,
because he didn't have the other markings, but he had the thing around his neck. And I only picked
the actual scars
that were not covered up by the tattoos. I only picked that up after rewatching. You know, it's one of those things. Yeah, wow.
And that's just it. Like, it's so, and I mean, like, I could geek out forever. So I'll just say one last thing is just the language also of the belters is phenomenal. They got like real linguists to work on it. It's like kind of like giving that New Orleans drawl in some ways, but then it's like, it's space.
Amazing.
It has, like, it's nothing like we have here exactly. It's just like this pieces of these other ones, and it feels very organic, natural. They have their own like words for things, and like the Boss Ming, those kinds of things. That is just like that would be a natural progression
right.
We would have had. Those things exactly. But if you're thinking of all these people who originated from Earth, like where they originated from, the people that they would have been bringing to the belt to do that work would have been like lower class folks. So their language was already very specific. And so then it's then developing throughout time in space. It just like, I can't like, it's just amazing. So I'm ready to hop in. So let's talk about The Expanse.
Let's do it.
I'd love to start with the cast, just because we were talking about Afrofuturism, right? And it is this idea of seeing ourselves in the future, right? And it kind of like, because we're here, right? We're here now. We're going to be here then. And so there was something really just beautiful about all the folks that we saw on screen and the representation in that, not just with like Naomi, but Kara Drummer, Gunny. Oh my God, I always forget how to say her name.
Vassarala?
the politician.
Vassarala.
Yes. Right, Vassarala. Oh my God.
Like,
yes. And so, yeah. Go.
No, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, it's the whole world building aspect of, like, you know, I mean, it's one thing in terms of, I mean, for lack of a better term, the diversity that was a part of this universe, and how it was structured between the Belters, the Earthers, the Martians, the Inners, you know, just all the language and everything. But like you brought up earlier, the cast of women, the powerhouse women, like mm-hmm. you said, there was Gunner, Gunny or Drum, Bobby, right? Who was the Martian, mm-hmm. like sergeant, and then Vassarala, who was the politician. Of course, and it all begins with Julie Andromeda Mao. My cat's name is Andromeda, by the way. And it was just like, I didn't realize that was, I didn't realize that was Julie's middle name until I watched it again. You know, I hadn't paid attention to that.
That's so perfect.
Yeah, but it's great. And so, but I mean, she started the whole thing as like this activist and the one that kind of was the seed that kind of began the journey for Miller and the others. But then, oh yeah, Drummer. I mean, my God, Drummer's amazing. And of mm-hmm. course, Naomi, yes. you know, but then, and what was the other character's name? I guess it was Julie's sister. I know she mm-hmm. became a...
Clarissa, right?
Was it Clarissa? Yeah, because she became more important in the later seasons. But there was just character after character, mm-hmm. strong female leads, you know, I mean, it was just incredible. And then also too, just the characters that like left you, like, I love Miller. I mean, I was glad that he came back as the Avatar because I missed him. You know, I didn't mm-hmm. want him to be gone. So he was like Obi-Wan coming back to talk to Luke. And then, but then also Amos was just the straight, I was trying to wrap my brain.
Oh my gosh.
And then it wasn't until I did a rewatch, right? Where you're learning that there was this technique where there was like some magnetic kind of methodology that kind of removed the empathy from their caudal lobes or something. But it was just like, oh, okay. So, you know, he really has been touched by something. And it really, really made an interesting conversation around violence, you know, which I think was an interesting mm-hmm. theme. The way that they dealt with it, because, you know, the Martians were so much embodying that kind of warfare attitude, which is kind of a timeless association with that planet and that energy. But then also mm-hmm. There were many scenes where like I remember when Holden killed his first person, like first human, when mm-hmm. when Naomi told what was the pilot's name? I want to call him Jesse, but it's not.
I don't remember.
I know. I don't know why I want to call him Jesse.
But you know the
pilot I'm talking about, right? Yeah. So the Rossi pilot, when he was like, he had really tried to enforce Naomi to kill someone. They were kind of doing a standoff, waiting for some folks to come through the door. And he was like, when they come through, blast them. And she kind of got mad. They didn't end up having to. But the fact that she was like, you don't get to tell me who to kill, you know, but it was this idea that there was really such a preservation around life, like not wanting to use violence by certain people, but then other people like Amos mm-hmm. and even Miller, right, were killing people willy nilly. Like they were just dropping folks like flies mm-hmm. Because they had a detachment in some kind of way to the violence and the killing of humans, you know, or the way people would just get spaced. You know what I mean? For no reason at all. You know, it was interesting the way some people really saw a value of life and others really had a very opposing attitude to that. That was something that resonated with me.
Yeah, I think the understanding of violence was like the different ways that we can understand violence and the different ways violence can serve certain purposes, mm-hmm. right? like even to just thinking of like Marco Inaros or any of the, you know, like there's a, that through line of like the rebellion for the Belters always trying to get their freedom, right? Just to be able to live their lives from under the boot. And so up until he really takes it too far, there is this kind of acknowledgement that like some of this violence makes sense, right? At some point we have to fight back, or some of this we have to push back on these oppressive forces because they're just going to continue to do that to us. And I really appreciated that. And it's not until it became this more like selfish, like I'm this, you know, corrupted leader version of him, where then he started doing it just like he became that villain, which is what happens oftentimes when you have like rebellious characters in media, and then they turn them into the villain.
Well, like so that it can be like,
no one
character.
Get any ideas. Exactly.
Yeah, because a lot of people felt the same about Killmonger and Black Panther, with the idea that, you know, I mean, they could see his points, you know, and what Killmonger was fighting against and standing for. But the idea that, you know, some things started as good intentions, but then at the same time, like you said, there's a fine line between being a rebel and a tyrant, you know, and a dictator, someone who's really going to be a terrorist almost, you know.
Yeah, like Namor too, talking about Black Panther. He had very valid fears and reasons for reacting the way that he did, and so a lot of people complained that there was like, we could have handled this a little better, there didn't need to be infighting. But it also makes me think of like, because this really stems from this sense of justice, and so something that Kat often talks about, and I'm going to pass it over to them, is a sense of justice, and specifically when we're looking at Amos, who can be interpreted as being coded as being neurodivergent or being on the spectrum, there are some really amazing things that come with that, because I wasn't expecting to like him, because he seemed like, if he didn't have like the being on like the aspects of being on the spectrum, he just would have been a jerk,
right?
He just would have been like, oh, I just shoot people and I don't care. But it became a place of like, I'm protecting the people I love, and it's just like, that's what it looks like for me. So I know Kat has a lot to say about that. So I want to pass it over to you.
See, I loved Amos.
I love
he's
him.
He's an entire problem, but I absolutely love him. Mostly just from like the fact that, from like what you were saying, is like there's a lot of problems with the fact that they kind of turned him into a murder hobo, which is something that like they do to neurodivergent people a lot. And I mean, I don't know if that's exactly what they were going for in representing him how they did, but like in my perspective and watching like how he reacts to other people, it seemed like the care was there, but that it really just depended on what side of your of the sense of justice or loyalty end that you were. Like specifically, I think in the fourth or fifth season, where he has like that whole like arc where he is dealing with the fact that he has like met someone he actually likes on this planet, and they have like a lot of stuff in common, and then she just is unfortunately on the side of this like really evil narcissist man who's like really just manipulating her to be a gun. When
I forgot about that.
Like when they're on the, like that planet. And like you get to see like, I think that was like a season that really humanized him in a lot of ways, where because you really did get to see like his conflict with that, and like the fact that like he was very upset he had to kill her. He did not want to do that because he did like her, and it like went against his sense of justice, honestly. But she was the thing. She chose the wrong side, or whatever right or wrong is in this world. And you know, he has to make this really tough decision. And then in like the fifth season, where he's like helping Clarissa Mao get out of the prison, and like you're kind of getting to see his childhood and all the trauma, as you said, like this like cyclical violence that he's experienced, and then also like how he's had to like establish his sense of like what is right and wrong. And he delivers a line that I was watching the fifth season today, because I was still trying to like finish it in a desperate effort to get to the end, so I knew exactly what was happening. But there was the part where he was just like, you know, you don't have to be a good person to lead a good life. It's just like about the choices that you make. Like you have to actively choose to do that. And that's something I feel like we talk a lot on the show about, is that like being a good person isn't necessarily a static sense of being. Like that's how people like get way too obsessed with like, I need to be perceived as a good person, but I'm not going to actually take the necessary steps to do things that are good. And then, I mean, not that Amos necessarily does that all the time, because he definitely thinks he's on the right side and the show positions him as if he is, but you definitely get, like, he's doing some pretty arguably bad things throughout.
Yeah.
But the whole perspective of, you know, you're the choices in a lot of ways, the choices you make, and that can always change. Like, there's always a place for redemption. Is something that I thought was really hopeful about his character arc. And I think transformed him, at least for me.
Yeah, no, I really like the things you shared about him, because I think that's why it's great to really rewatch these. If you've got the time, right, to actually rewatch some of these like epic series, because you know, when I realized, because I only got to the end of season two, you know, I started watching like last week. And the thing about Amos is that, you know, there may be something going on with him and his empathy, right? And whether he's on the spectrum or not, I don't know if we ever really know his real deal. But he, like you said, he definitely cares about his people, you know, and even strangers, because when they were on the Tycho station, and he noticed somebody in the bar, and they were being ogled by somebody that really was up to no good, and had a knife, had a weapon. And he kind of casually went over and said, "Hey, just beware, that guy's packing a knife," or something like that. You know what I mean? And he was just, because he's observant and he's very objective, and he was just like, "Be careful," because he understood. He came from that kind of environment. He grew up in it, and he knew what to expect. And what kind of dangers to look out for. And he was looking out for other people. And it did show, actually, that when they were looking for May, you know, the little girl and the scientist, the botanist, the father of the little girl, May, you know, he was having these outbursts where he was trying to protect people. And even Naomi and these others would be like, "Yo, chill out. Like, you can't just kill people." And just like, you know, you got to have a measured way of approaching. Now, mind you, they got the witness, you know, to spill the beans, you know what I mean? But nobody could say anything, because he was like, "Isn't that what you wanted?" But at the same time, he beat him from an inch of his life, you know, and that's what everybody was afraid of. And so I didn't like how Holden threw it in his face when he was like, "That's why Naomi's afraid of you," you know, because it's true. It's like that. He knew that would really hurt him, because obviously Naomi was like a sister to him, and he didn't want people to fear him, you know, so he knew there was something up with him. And I think you said, you know, his arc didn't really come until like, you know, season five or so, when he actually got to dig deeper into, like, go back to Earth and figure out, because I think it was from Baltimore, right? Or something like that. And figure out like what happened with him, and why he was the way he was, and how to transform and work through that. But he was struggling with it from season one, you know?
Yeah, I think it's just how complex everyone is in trying to navigate this very complicated world, and just like the different identities that you hold. And I think also just the existence of these different people in power. Like, I really enjoyed Kara Drummer, right? Like, she was someone who had to kind of grow on me, but then I was like, she's like so real, right? Like, if anyone should be, you know, leading them, it's her. She's, because she'll do what needs to be done, but she's also very diplomatic about it too. Like, even though she was like, Marco Zanaris is a problem, right? But everyone else like had voted. And so she's like, to be fair, they voted for that, so he has to live, right? We have to let him go. And it is like, no one else has been able to kind of like put their own feelings and thoughts like on the back burner in the same way that she does. And she just always had like that sense of community, even in her relationship, when they like show later that she's in like a polyamorous like relationship on her ship. Like, it was like, I was like, okay.
I love that dynamic, how they did that. Because she was shown to be a really emotional being, you know, like, even though she had this tough exterior, she showed to be an emotional being. She didn't want folks to leave her. Like, she didn't want to have to say goodbye, because it can be a lonely life out there in space, you know, from port to port, you know what I mean? And so I could really see that emotional side of her, but she was hella loyal. Like, she was a very loyal leader. She had that strength, tough as nails. Like, She took shots, you know, lasers, all kinds of things. And then when she used those machines to get her back to when she was walking or whatever. And she, I mean, mm-hmm. that was incredible. But like, I noticed, I don't know if you all are fans of Battlestar Galactica, the new series, right? But they handled relationships in a similar way. This idea of polyamory, which is something that I think even in Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, there was a bit of that. This idea of relationships of the future, you know what I mean? And it's kind of going with the natural rhythm of like, one minute you're here, one minute you're not. You're traveling here. I mean, when you got hyperspace and stuff, you don't know where you're going to end up, what planet, what port. And so it's kind of like, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. And that was kind of the MO in Battlestar Galactica. And so in seeing it here, it was interesting because it really felt like people really cared for these, like this network of lovers and those relationships were not so kind of casual. They really felt like they were building bonds and like really meaningful connections, which was a different spin on it, you know, that I thought they handled pretty nicely.
Yeah, like our concept of like family and just like community transforms when you're in those spaces. Butler always did that, like even in her Lilith's Brood series, and Jemison too in the Broken Earth trilogy has polyamory in that too, because it's like at some point we live in this place where we can acknowledge that people are doing different things for each other, right? Like you're supplying and giving someone a piece of them that they need, right? That other people are going to supply a different thing, right? And that's just like, that's the future, right? Like we're transforming the way that we understand the world and our being, and then also our relationships with people, which is another level to why The Expanse is so phenomenal.
Something so great about Drummer too is that like that never at any point did they let their ego steer. It is always their like loyalty and their honor that you don't always like, even of Asarella, like there's a whole arc in season 5 where like she really lost her way for a little bit and like really has to get back to like realizing like, oh, I don't need to be in power to still do the right thing. And like there's like so much going on where lots of characters are like wrestling as well with their own ego in like one ways that like aren't the worst thing. Like Marcus Inaris is an entire different situation where the ego is his entire downfall. But you see a lot of characters that are in power wrestling with her ego. And I appreciated that, like, she didn't really ever have that as an arc. Like, she was just, like, loyal and driven and, like, deeply cared about people. Yeah. And especially, like, the people in her community. And that was, like, really cool to see as a character like that.
And I like the relationship between her and Naomi. Like, I really liked... Yeah. I like the relationship between her and Naomi and Naomi and Miller. Like, you know, the Belters had a bond that, you know, you really felt like, because I had to ask myself, like, who would I be with? Would I be Earthers, Belters? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like you, though, Gabe, I can't handle space. So I don't think I'd be a rock hopper. I don't think I would make it past Earth's orbit. But, you know, in terms of, like, just the community, like, I really enjoyed, you know, just like the love they had and the loyalty they had for each other, and just like the love and grit that they had was very much like, you know, Philly folks, you know, I could kind of relate, you know.
Yeah. And I really just appreciated that the show from the very beginning had this like worker power, like revolution, just thread throughout that took different forms. Like it was happening on Mars, like ways to like take back power and not just be cogs in a machine. It's happening on Earth and just trying to like reconcile with the people who are in power who are just like not working in our best interests, and then especially the Belters and constantly trying to fight, even going as far as like leaving the system entirely to get somewhere that they could just call their own, like just leave us alone, like we don't want to belong to anyone anymore. And that was just like a really powerful message, and that's like one of the things I really appreciate about Naomi too, was her always grappling with that. Like there was her own personal journeys that she was going through, but at the end of the day, like Drummer, she was really trying to figure out for everyone too. Like that was like what motivated her right from the beginning to do what she was doing. And it was like a constant battle of like, how much of me is like a Belter and a part of this revolution, and how much of me is just Naomi who's trying to like live and exist and just love. Mm-hmm. And that was a refreshing just like view to see how complex even the folks who are like doing the work, like how complex they can be too.
Yeah.
It felt very real, right?
And we see the this, dynamic. Like,
yeah. No, sorry, Kat, what were you saying?
No, I was just saying, it was like, you really see this like baton pass of like the same message over and over that ultimately is workers' power, but also like escaping oppression and like trying to overthrow the powers that be that are like doing the harm. And then like each villain in a sense is like having this like baton pass of like worker power matters, or you're fighting for worker power and that's not the villain, and then it is the villain, and you have like this whole story arc that's, you really see every level of revolution, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even thinking about the corporate side of things with Mao and like
right.
why we have the protomolecule right. and all those things, like it's very complex for anyone who hasn't seen The Expanse. I do highly recommend, just because it is like it does take a long time,
but
I feel like once you're in, you're like, I can't stop. Like, what is time? What are other responsibilities that I have in life?
Yeah, I'm going to continue because I'm going to be watching season 3 and I'm going throughout, you know what I mean? Even though, you know, we're doing our business now. But the thing is that, you know, this is as complex as Game of Thrones or even Dune, like the Dune mm-hmm. epic, you know, or any yeah. of like the Star Wars. I mean, that's how comprehensive and vast this, you know, story world is. It's a multiverse because there's just so many things, like, you know, that are so developed to such detail, from the Martian world to Earth, the Belters, everything in between, and the science. I mean, I thought that they did, I mean, because I have some of my friends who are also fans of the show, when we were watching together, we would kind of like geek out and be like, you know, that's actually real science, or like, because everyone wanted to know,
yeah,
could Naomi be out there in the vacuum, you know what I mean? Could she uh-huh. survive? What could happen? You know what I mean? So many of the kind of challenging, tense moments, you know, that we remember from the series are kind of based on, like, you know, figuring out the science stuff that, like, really, you know, came down to, like, the intelligence. Let's talk about, and that's the thing. That's one of the things that I love, the intelligence of Naomi Nagata. Like, the fact that from season mm-hmm. 1, they made it very clear, like, why is she even on this ship? She's so smart. Like, she's smarter than the whole lot of you.
Yeah.
Everyone knew
yeah.
That she was of another league, you know what I mean? And I loved how that really mm-hmm. was, I mean, you know, of course, I think she was a beautiful person as well, you know, on the outside, but it was also about just like, you know, her being such an asset to the team. Like, from Holden to Amos yeah. to everybody was like, we can't do this without you. And so much of the power of some of like the typical male hero characters were supported and fueled by Naomi at the heart, you know, which very much like the Matrix, mm-hmm. you know, even though the Matrix was about Neo and him being the one, we know he couldn't have done that without Trinity. None of that would have happened if it yeah. wasn't for Trinity. It was, Naomi is just like, for me, like, I don't know what's going to top, because there's just so many characters out there, and I know there are going to be so many more to come, but I feel like she's going to be one of the timeless characters, at least in my book, you know?
Yeah, she's given me, oh my God, it was just there. Firefly, right?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, like, having her as, like, she's the powerful one, right? Like, she's the enforcer. And for this, it's like, she is, like, the engineer, right? She's the one who's rerouting or reprogramming our ship so that we're read as something else. Like, what if it could, and reprogram, like, what she's doing, that whole really stressful thing with like the oxygen,
oh,
she runs out
God.
To do the thing, and I was like, I don't even understand what you're doing, and I'm so stressed
yeah.
To get the message out, like, that was insane. Yeah, and I have seen like articles and stuff from like, you know, astrophysicists and things like that. They were like, yeah, this is real. Like, that's how that works. That's how that operates. Right. Like, they did their research. Yeah. they figured out, like, of course, you would the belters are really long, like even more so in the books, because they were really putting in that effort of understanding like what happens to our bodies in space, things like that. Yeah, so much work. Like, everything was intentional, and I really appreciated that. Like, it's so easy to just like make up like sciencey words.
It is.
Like mumble jumble, like just word soup.
But they were like, they want this to make sense. Like, give me the juice. Like, the juice. I was like, they must need that juice, because how are they gonna get through this hyperdrive situation, like the high G or whatever it was. But did you, like, they actually explained all of that, because that's how Homeboy passed. I don't want to give anything away for you, Kent. But anyway, like,
oh, it's okay. I already read it. Oh, you're okay. Good.
But with the pilot, like, I don't know if that's how he dies in the books, but the idea of like having a stroke from that high G situation, you know, they broke down the science of that with that voiceover. It was like a strange kind of you know, description. They tried to give us like this contextual information through that voiceover, where this guy was talking about how what happens to you when you do the juice and the high G situation. But I think, you know, hats off to Dominique Tipper, because it really takes a strong actress, you know, someone like to be able to perform such a character of high intelligence, you know, because if you don't have that intelligence to deliver those lines and act like you actually
remember it all.
I mean, because she sold that. Like, I believe that she could rewire the Rosinante if she had to. I'm talking about Dominique. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's something that she could do.
She was something else, like super powerful in all different ways, and never like a shadow to Holden, which was, I was really thankful for. I always struggle with like
chosen one
archetypes, and especially when it's just like a random white guy. That's why I was like, we're not covering Dune, you know. But she wasn't like a second, right? It was, she was equal, or she was in her whole other lane doing her own thing, and was incredibly significant, and so was every one of the others, right? And I think that's amazing.
I struggled with Holden, honest, you know. It took a while for me to like him, you know. And I think it was for that reason, you know, because I felt like she was clearly the baddie of the group, you know what I mean? I'm trying to sound smart. And then when like he became the savior, and like, you know, we started seeing his face on the murals and stuff, because that was a part of the storyline. And remember the cant, and he became like the poster child for the revolution. And I was just like, he was a reluctant captain. He didn't even want the job, you know, but
it didn't need to be him, but they put him there. I agree.
And then like later when he's the only one who can see, I was like, I'm so aggravated. This whole season is the worst. When everyone like had the like that planet illness, where everyone was going blind, and he had to like literally walk. Yeah,
I didn't like that.
And he like literally had to walk them around.
He had the magic eye juice.
Yes,
to save everybody, like, for whatever reason.
I couldn't. Of course, I was like, let it be Amos. Like, let it be somebody else. Like, whatever. And even still, he did try to be pretty humble about it, which I was like, okay, fine.
Yeah. Well, and the last thing I was going to say, though, about Holden is that, you know, in the intro, even though they try to disguise a little bit, you don't see really anyone's face, right? Because it's all like the like cosmic scapes and like little silhouettes, little astronauts and stuff. But then the last scene, you see somebody in a helmet, and I know it's Holden in there, you know, and of all the people, you feel like it should have been Naomi. If you're going to show one human's face inside the suit, you know, as the iconic image, I felt like, why didn't you put Naomi in there? But it was Holden, you know, it was Holden.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. And I like, he out of all the somewhat chosen one white guy heroes, he's one of the more enjoyable ones. Definitely because of being humble and just like where he came from, and like, you know, his little like commune family of like 20 parents
right?
Like,
eight moms,
cute, you know,
eight moms and 10 dads or something. And he had some cute dimples. He grew on me though. He did grow on me though, I have to say.
Yeah, Oh yeah, I had such a crush on Stephen Strait in high school. So seeing him, I was like, "Oh, this is where you were." Because you gotta
watch the. What else was he on?
I've never seen really, him before. Cringy. There was a film that I watched in high school where he. It was like male witches. Game doesn't like want to admit this. On the swim team. I was such a big fan. It's called The Covenant. It's a terrible film. It is so silly. I've heard of it. But it was male witches, and he was like at the lead of it. And I was like, oh my God, he's so cute. And they were in the swim team. So they were always like,
oh, really?
In their Speedos, getting ready to jump in the pool. And I was like, wow, okay. Yeah.
He does show some guns towards the film. I mean, eventually I was like, okay, this is who we're rocking with. Yeah. This is going to be the dude. But I will say, I did have a space crush on Naomi's ex, though, even though he was a maniacal crazy man, but you know.
Yes.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's what he had that charisma, you know? Yeah. Like, I was like, okay, I get it. Like, or I understand why Naomi did all the things that she did leading up
to
the worst decision of her life. I get it. And it was, yeah. You tell me things, I'm listening.
Right. He must have been nice before. There was a time before his little, before he went over the edge, I bet he was A-okay. I bet he was A-okay. Yeah.
He was probably inspiring, you know, and just like, he probably really appreciated Naomi too, like in her brain. And then, it, you know, probably got corrupted in that way. But yeah, there's just... There's so much to talk about when it comes to Expanse, which is because it's so many series and it's also like so many seasons, and then there's also books.
It's never ending.
There's also like things outside of the pilot that you're talking about. His death is not like that in the books. I don't know if that character's in the books. His death was drastic like that because of the actor had some problems.
Did he pass away for real?
They had to kill him off because he did bad things in real life. So he's a terrible human. So they, because I was like, that was abrupt. That was weird.
I know.
It was smart the way they did it, but it was abrupt, and it was because. And I looked it up because I was like, what did he do?
Smart. I didn't even think of it because it was very natural because he was worried about that. They kind of foreshadowed it because he was worried about that juice and his head exploding. You know what I mean? On the high G. Burn, yeah. You know what I mean? He was worried about that. Oh, now I'm going to have to look it up.
Because, I mean, he knew it was being written off. They were very smart about it. Wow. I think it was very interesting. Okay. It's such a brilliant show, even in just that, like in handling situations like that. But since we're wrapping up here, I just wanted to see if you could let folks know where they can follow you, what you're working on now, so they can kind of keep up on the different projects that you're working on and Myth Studios and on all that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, it's been a pleasure to talk about The Expanse with you too. Thank you for the invitation. So you can find me on Instagram at Myth Media Studios. And I have a new website coming. It's going to be at mythmediastudios.art, A-R-T. And I'm currently working on a kind of additional chapter of Afrofuturist myth and epic story. Called Graffiti in the Grass. It's a transmedia narrative that's being told across multiple platforms. And part of it takes place through the platform of a mobile app. We're working on a graphic novel element of it. And right now, the next chapter, Illadelph Dreams, is going to be an immersive theater production. I'm working in collaboration with Theater in the X, a Black-led theater company here in Philly, and various local artists to kind of make that a reality. But we are kind of, you know, in the spirit of Octavia Butler, thinking about the near future and thinking about the issues and the concerns and the hopes and the dreams of this city. Of Philadelphia, you know, where I was born and raised, and thinking about what it's going to be like in the future, and kind of looking at that through the lens of the story world of Blade Runner, which is one of my favorite films of all time. And so I've always thought about this idea of like, you know, Blade Runner takes place in LA, but what if, you know, what was happening in Philly at the time? And also how might we imagine that through the Afrofuturist lens, you know, because the Blade Runner, Ridley Scott's version anyway, you know, there are no Black people in that future. At least we didn't see them, but we know they're somewhere. So hopefully through this theater production, we'll get to explore about, you know, race and technology and artificial intelligence and where Philly kind of fits into that story. So hopefully that'll be coming out in the fall of this year, at least some element of it for the theater stage. So
that's awesome.
That is amazing.
We'll have so to come exciting. See.
Definitely follow Lee. You're always like, whether it's something you're working on or you're like uplifting someone else's project, just like in that space, it's always so hopeful and just like exciting and like creative. And it's like, I didn't even think to do that, like mobile app. Which is just super exciting to rethink technology.
Well, I have to say too, I gotta give a shout out to Swim Pony. Swim Pony is an immersive theater production company that basically commissioned 10 different writers to write their own story and match it with a trail that was supported through the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. And I got Bartram's Mile, which is out there in Southwest Philly. And so my story is kind of activated by GPS, and you walk the trail and the story advances as you get to different markers on the trail. So that, I mean, that was not my invention. Because again, I struggle with technology. That's my relationship with it. You know, shout out to Gen Xers. But for me, all I had to do was actually write the story and cast the characters. There are lots of local Philly artists that were cast in the story. And, you know, that was, again, just another element. It was called Chronicles of Asylum. And that was another chapter of Graffiti in the Grass, like Illadelph Dreams will be. But yeah, you know, there's so many stories to be told in this city. And Gabe, I'm looking forward to working with you in some capacity. We got to find a way to collaborate.
Yes. Yeah. There's, I got ideas. I got them all brewing up here. And that's what I'm really excited about. Even just this series is to be able to look at, you know, what envisioned futures we've already had. And then to look at it in this way of understanding where we are now, especially because when we look at like, you know, the years that the future times took place in, and it was like yesterday.
Right.
It's like, well, we're not there. So where will we be? Like, how does that
work? Blade Runner was 2019, I think. It was like LA 2019. Yeah. I'm like, oh, that's yesteryear.
2019, just in future. Like Back to the Future. It was like,
I know. But yeah, listen, so, Gabe, I want to know that, like, if you ever do the cosplay thing, let me know who I, with the Expanse, let me know who I can dress up as, because I will come. Maybe I'll do Avi Sarala or something. Yeah. Or I'll dress up as Gunny or Drummer. Yes. I don't know, we'll figure something out. The crew of the Rosamonte, we'll figure it out.
Yes absolutely. Anytime to dress up. Like I said, I was there at the Fan Expo, and it was like, because there's not a lot, like the fan base for the Expanse is pretty small, but the people who are there are like hardcore. So like anyone, yeah, it's like, you know, unless you're going specifically to like a, maybe a sci-fi convention, you might have a better chance.
But it was
like, there was a few people who like, when they saw me, it was like, oh my God, like you did it. Like, this is amazing. And then like anybody else would be like, what is that? Who is that? You know? But if you know, like,
no,
you know.
I'm often introducing it to my friends. A lot of people don't know about the Expanse yet, you know? And I gotta admit, it took me a while. Like, yeah. I had a friend who was just like, you haven't seen this yet? And I was just like, I don't know if it has something to be because it's on Amazon. I don't know. Like, it just wasn't my go-to platform for series like that. But ever since, I've been sold, you know, Amazon got the goods. At least for the Expanse anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, talk about evil corporations.
I know, right. You can bleep that out if you want. Right. But I mean, that's where you're gonna find the Expanse.
Yes. But definitely listen, definitely follow Lee, and join us in for the rest of this series. We're going to be talking about all kinds of science fiction works. We're going to have a guest to talk about Star Trek, which will be really exciting, and some other things that are coming down the way for this summer series. Thank you again, Lee, for joining us.
Thanks, Kat. Thanks,
Gabe. And don't get married.
Thanks to the ghouls next door.
Sure.
Bye.